From WXXI News, I'm Jasmine Singer, and this is Environmental Connections. Today's Environmental Connection begins with a simple yet perplexing question. Why are people still moving to areas increasingly vulnerable to climate change? Hurricanes, wildfires, floods, and extreme heat are becoming more frequent and severe. Yet places like Florida and Texas and California continue to see population growth in these high-risk regions. What's behind this paradox? Is it simply a matter of economic opportunities, or are people unaware of the growing dangers? For example, we know that between 2000 and 2023, Florida added over 3 million new residents through domestic migration, many of whom have settled in areas prone to hurricanes. Just last year, Hurricane Helene delivered record-setting flooding to the Tampa Bay region, yet the influx of people into these areas shows no sign of slowing down. It's not just Florida. Cities like Phoenix, known for its scorching heat and the wildfire-prone foothills of California's Sierra Nevada, have also seen rapid population growth despite these risks. So why is this happening? How are people making decisions about where to live, and what role does climate change education or perhaps misinformation play in shaping those decisions? Today, I'm joined by three experts to help us unpack this complex issue. In the studio with me is Lawrence Turcello, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the Rochester Institute of Technology, who's going to talk to us today about how philosophical and political dimensions of climate denialism impact public perception. Larry, thanks so much for being here.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Did I say your last name correctly? Turcello?
Turcello,
yes. Excellent. Okay, good. And on the phone, we have Dr. Joe A. Henderson, a visiting faculty member at the University of Vermont, whose research focuses on the state of climate education and how it intersects with migration and climate politics. Joe, welcome to Environmental Connections.
Hi, everybody. Glad to be here.
And you have some Rochester roots, right?
I do. I lived there for almost 11 years. One of my children was born at Highland Hospital. I did my PhD at the University of Rochester. And I'm a former middle school earth science teacher at Rush Henrietta. Go Royal Comets.
Okay. I love that. And finally, also joining us remotely is Rebecca K. Zarger, an anthropologist from the University of South Florida, who's been studying how social and environmental inequalities intersect with climate change, particularly in Florida. Becky, hi. Welcome to Environmental Connections.
Hi. I'm glad to be here.
So glad that you are joining us. I know you will have a very important perspective to offer to this conversation. Larry, let's start with you. We've seen people continue to move into disaster-prone areas like Florida and Texas, despite clear evidence that these areas are becoming more dangerous. Can you help us understand how climate denialism might be influencing these decisions?
Well, to my mind, it's a reflection of the kind of attitudes people have around politics also. So before the show, I looked up what the number one concern for voters are this election. And unsurprisingly, and I knew this already, but to confirm, it's economic issues, inflation, and things of that nature. And I think even if somebody is aware of climate change, there's sort of a light, I'll call it light sense of denialism, when people put that very low on the list of issues that they care about. And I think it's a parallel sort of forgetfulness about climate change, or putting it in the back burner because it's so uncomfortable to think about. And it seems to me that people probably move to Florida for many financial reasons around taxes, et cetera, things like that, for instance.
And I know you've written about the concept of, I think you call it pseudo-skepticism, where people reject scientific consensus despite having access to accurate information. Can you talk about how that plays out in terms of public attitudes toward climate risks?
Yeah, so pseudo-skepticism, the way I think about it, is something that's akin to pseudoscience. Science itself is a very skeptical activity, and it's a rigorous methodological form of skepticism. Everything in the scientific process, when it's going well, is aimed at challenging a favored hypothesis and ruling out possibilities until it becomes clear that this this is what reality is like to the best of our ability to judge. When we're dealing with something like pseudoscience, often what happens is that people will take on the trappings and authority of science, but it's false. They have a different ideological point of view, or that they are interested in promoting, or a favored hypothesis that they're looking to promote despite any counter evidence. And pseudoskepticism is like that. When you have the overwhelming scientific consensus that we do on climate change, and you have somebody who's a politician or from the fossil fuel industry who clearly has economic and ideological reasons to deny that consensus, what often happens is you hear people talk about the virtues of skepticism, the importance of challenging ideas in science, but also ignoring that that's the very reason we have the overwhelming consensus on climate change right now, because that process has played out. So to challenge it from a lay point of view is a form of false skepticism or pseudo-skepticism.
Is there something inherent to human nature that makes it difficult to process climate risk?
I think so. I think it's so disturbing. You know, very personally, the more that I've looked into this, the longer I've looked into this, the more depressing it becomes to see people ignoring it continuously. And the feeling of helplessness that people have, I think that is a good motivator in making them sort of tune this sort of thing out. So I think there's a direct link there. Mm. And also, as you know, when it comes to conspiracy theory, the idea of helplessness is also a motivating factor there. It's weirdly comforting, social sciences have found in investigating conspiracy theory, to believe that there's a group of people who are villainous behind the scenes, controlling factors that otherwise would seem out of human control. And as strange as it sounds, thinking that there's some conspiracy going on is a perverse way of comforting oneself. Mm. So there's a lot of overlap here.
And it seems likely that people who move into the high-risk areas that we were talking about are well-intentioned and want to do what's right for their families. So what role do ideological biases play in shaping these decisions?
Shaping the decisions to move to a specific place?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I don't know that there's any robust ideological decisions to move to a place other than often being close to one's family, following perhaps a dream that one has had from a young age to live in a warmer climate, things of that nature that come to the forefront. And climate change, if it's a thought at all in most people's minds, is way, way down there on the list.
Well, we have already an email from a listener. Charles says, it's not really that puzzling. Two out of the three states mentioned have low taxes and high personal freedom. Pretty good combo right there. Do you have any reactions to that, Larry?
Well, I guess the personal freedom comment does tie into ideological concerns. So the idea is that take some place like Florida or Texas, being very red states, the idea often in the conservative mindset is that these are places where there's a lot more freedom. As an academic, I would point out that that's not really the case, especially in a place like Florida, where there's a lot of governmental intrusion into academic curriculums. But ideology is like that. You sort of lead with the belief that you have, and you don't look for anything to contradict it.
And we'll get much more into all of that, especially the Florida part of it. But let's turn to Joe. Joe, what is the state of climate education, and how effectively would you say young people are connecting the science to their everyday lives, including where they might want to live?
Talk about that. Hey, Larry, it's been a while since we've chatted. I have a lot I could add to that as well, specifically around like different understandings of freedom. And I spend a lot of time in Scandinavia, and they have a very different understanding of freedom, and they don't generally see Americans as very free, which I think is an interesting conversation we could have another time. But I mean, I guess in terms of climate education, like when you think about climate education and actually, I just want to, I guess, maybe interject some statistics into this conversation
sure.
at this point. You know, there's been some really good survey research from places like the Yale Climate Opinions, Climate and Communication Project that show something like 75% of Americans believe in climate change, think we should be doing something about it, think we should be teaching and learning about it in schools and museums and things like that. Climate education across the United States is really a big patchwork because of the federated nature of the U.S. educational system. And so it really does depend where you are. And of course, you know, some states do really well with this. New Jersey, California is really ramping it up. They tend to be bluer states. There are variegated geographic patterns within those states. And so there's a kind of liberal conservative divide in some of those places. You can see that even in upstate New York. I'm actually in the Adirondacks right now. It's a kind of very conservative place. And so it's, you know, all of that said, I guess, large majorities of Americans like accept climate science and want people to kind of teach and learn about it. That is, of course, much higher among young people, but it's also a majority opinion among young Republicans, I mean, who otherwise have political leaders that, for reasons that have to do with some of the stuff that Larry was talking about, you know, capture by oil interests, things like that, you know, have take positions that are different from their constituents. And so, you know, you do have actually broad acceptance for these things. I think, you know, you were talking about climate science denial, and I think actually Larry did a really nice job of talking about the reasons for it, but I think one of the things that we're really grappling with or starting to grapple with in the United States is something that people in quote unquote developing countries have been grappling with for a long, long time, which is the implications of colonialism, global capitalism, the kind of things that are at like root causes of climate change mm-hmm. and certain forms of using land to create wealth. And so when I look at this, I look at how some of those processes are starting to kind of blow back into the United States. And we're starting to see, I mean, literally blow back into the United States in places like Florida, where we're seeing this kind of carbon-based development produce bigger storms around the world. I think in some ways, actually, it's much more comfortable for people to live in the kind of underneath the comfortable blanket of myth or denial than to accept the reality of who has caused climate change, you know, predominantly wealthy nations, who suffers from the effects now of climate change, predominantly marginalized people. And so like when we're talking about people moving around in the United States, and there's been long migrations over the history of the United States, I just want to, I guess, remind everybody that like 60-70% of people in the United States don't actually move very far from where they grew up. The people who do move tend to be the ones that have wealth, that can afford to move, that can afford to evacuate, you know, that can move to places like Asheville, North Carolina, right? Or Lake Placid, New York, and things like that. And so there are a whole lot of kind of social and economic inequalities that are playing themselves out in this terrain as well. And I think we need to think about it through that kind of lens as well.
Thank you for that. It's fascinating to me how education works to influence future migration patterns and current migration patterns. I'm wondering if I'm sure you had a chance to see the recent New York Times piece about this very subject. It pointed out that economic factors like job opportunities and affordable housing often overshadow concerns about natural disasters. So, Joe, how can educators balance teaching the science with helping students critically assess these practical everyday concerns?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So I work on something called the MEECE Project, which is, people want to look it up. It's MECCE.ca. It's an international research project that looks at kind of quality climate change education around the world. And one of the things that we're starting to figure out is that, you know, climate change education has to be more than just the cognitive dimensions. So, you know, it's important that people learn about climate science and the causes and effects and all of the kind of physical, natural parts of that. But you can't really stop there. You have to look at the social, emotional dimensions of that. So there's a ton of research right now being done on like youth emotions, hope, despair, kinds of conversations. But then it also has to be action oriented. And so there has to, you have to be able to do something with it. And one of the other layers to that, I think, is that you have to also have an awareness of the social patterns that are playing themselves out in this space, both in terms of causes and effects. And so, you know, climate change is not caused equally by everybody. It tends to be the wealthiest 10% in the world that have contributed to about 50% of all climate emissions. Mm. That tends to be a very global north phenomenon. So those tend to be wealthier countries like the United States, Canada, Australia. I have some research coming out on this soon. And, you know, wealth and race and gender and those things, those are the things that shape people's vulnerabilities. And so I guess I would, one of the things I would say is I would direct a lot of your listeners to something called the U.S. Climate Vulnerability Index, which is a project out of Texas A&M, where they've mapped basically like how vulnerable are different communities around the country and what are those vulnerabilities, access to healthcare, inequality, things like that, in addition to the kind of climate hazards that are increasingly intensifying. And I guess it should be no surprise that the places that are most vulnerable tend to be in the Southwest and in the Southeast. The places that are least vulnerable are places like where I am and, you know, up in the Adirondacks right now and near Lake Champlain. And so I think there are people who are starting to look at migration patterns that are coming and are kind of already existing around climate change. And I think it's going to be one of the dominant social forces in the next few decades, not just in the US, but also internationally. And I think we got to really get our heads around migration and immigration and we're having a political contest soon where, you know, both political parties are, you know, let me put this as delicately as possible, right? Like we're having a very, in my opinion, we're having a very frustrating conversation about migration and immigration in this country. Part of the reason why people show up to our southern border is because of things like climate change. Mm-hmm. We barely talk about that. And so I think we need a much more robust and kind of socially interesting conversation around what are the implications of a warming world socially. Yeah.
Thank you. So true. That's Joseph A. Henderson, Associate Professor of Social Sciences at Paul Smith's College, among many other things. And I'm also being joined today in the studio by Lawrence Torcello, Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of Philosophy at RIT. We also have joining us Rebecca K. Zarger, who is Associate Professor in the Department of Anthropology at the University of South Florida, which is something, a state that we keep talking about. So, Becky, let's turn to you. You've spent years studying how inequalities shape climate impacts, particularly in Florida. In recent weeks, we've seen some of the very scenarios that your team predicted about 10 years ago become a reality. Can you share more about what's happening in Florida now and how these impacts are playing out in terms of who gets hit hardest?
Yes, it has been kind of a wild, intense last couple of weeks. As you mentioned, I've been carrying out research with an interdisciplinary team looking at experiences of climate risk. And we've been thinking about this as kind of a problem of experiencing risk in the present while also simultaneously anticipating risk in the future. And I think that kind of double bind that people find themselves in is getting more intense. I think that the most recent events definitely have impacted me, you know, in my own life and my own backyard. A giant 100-year-old live oak fell in my garage office, so I had to move all my things out to storage. So definitely research hitting home is a bad pun. But I think, I was fortunate compared to many. I think one of the the things that struck me about your the question that you posed about the relationship between knowledge and understanding of potential climate risks, for example, when making a decision to move to Florida, in relation to the sort of economic aspect of that, I think is a really insightful one. So in thinking about the experiences of our interviewees over the last 10 years, as well as, you know, just recent conversations with friends and neighbors, the idea that people are moving to areas because they're completely unaware of risk, I think it kind of misses some of the complexity. I think oftentimes folks think about risk, but might be willing to kind of gamble to some extent because of the economic investment, for example, required to move to somewhere that's not as vulnerable to, you know, flooding, whether it's sunny day flooding or whether it's from an extreme rainfall event, as we saw with Hurricane Milton, where we received 12 to 28 inches of rain in the Tampa Bay area in a matter of a few hours. Mm-hmm. So I think the economic piece is important, but I also think that it really kind of intersects in complicated ways with some of the issues that our other guests have mentioned with regards to just thinking about the sort of ideology of how we understand risk. I've written about a concept with colleagues quite a while ago that we refer to as eco-myopia, and it's a term that some other folks have used as well. But the idea is that you kind of have a particular lens of viewing risk that may be shaped by many other factors, but ultimately it kind of results in either you know, avoiding thinking about the actual risks that you know are there, or choosing to respond to them. But you know, it's I think a complicated calculus. I think another element that is a really important piece here is the recent sort of expansion of suburban development, neighborhoods into wetlands. Areas that are low-lying and prone to flooding. And this is, of course, a pattern of sort of cyclical and expanding development in coastal areas really around the world. But Florida has been engaged in this for many decades. And I think the sort of acceleration of, you know, newer, sort of cheaper subdivisions and housing in areas that are known to be prone to flooding and storm surge have really exacerbated the problem. So some of the areas, for example, that experienced storm surge or flooding from rainfall in the most recent storms and Hurricane Milton, some of them were known areas of high risk. You know, it's like every time we have a tropical storm, there is a neighborhood called Shore Acres that's in Pinellas County that experiences flooding very often. It's often in the news. On the other hand, to your point about social inequalities, we also saw many areas in within the city of Tampa and within Hillsborough County, which is where I live, that experienced major flooding, catastrophic flooding that had never experienced that before. Mm. And the dynamic is a bit different than what we saw, for example, with Helene in Western North Carolina. But this was due to stormwater ponds having failures of generators. So it was an infrastructural failure. And I've also worked with colleagues at USF about the ways the location of stormwater ponds and the history of infrastructure injustice is kind of written into the waterscape of our city and our region. So those areas that experienced severe flooding, many of those locations are also neighborhoods where they have experienced multiple layers of injustice from social injustice. These are areas that experienced redlining, historically, or are in areas, unincorporated areas of Hillsborough County, where the infrastructure for both drinking water and for dealing with rainwater and runoff have had known issues for many decades, but those solutions really haven't been put into place. So I think all of this really brings to the forefront some of the issues that that we imagined happening 10 years ago when we worked on our conversations about climate futures for the Tampa Bay area and what that might look like. And I think some of the key pieces that we emphasized were thinking about, you know, where people might move, you know, from the sort of along the edge of the coastline within proximity of, you know, a couple of miles, for example, of the Gulf or the Bay. And we asked people to consider, you know, what would happen if population kind of moved inward. And I think we're going to be seeing kind of the effects of that over the next months to years. But one of the things that is very clear already is that people who rely on, you know, the bars and restaurants, the tourism industry yes. that is perched right along the coastline, those who are in, you know, the lowest income brackets who are already experiencing a lot of social inequalities because of the high cost of living are either unable to find work or being displaced.
Yes.
And, you know, really the only people who may be able to afford to rebuild their businesses or homes are those in the highest income bracket.
And that's not even considering the issue going on with homeowners insurance that is playing out, and the ability or inability to obtain homeowners insurance in these areas is definitely something that's shifting. And I'd love to get my panel of guests, your opinions on that and your predictions for that. But I first just want to invite callers who are already calling in, I love that, to join our conversation today on Environmental Connections. We're talking about why people are still moving to high-risk areas. And if you'd like to be in on the conversation, please join us, 844-295-8255, or you can email us at connections@wxxi.org. We already have some emails coming in, some phone calls coming in, so just hang tight. Larry, I want to bring you back in first. Does corporate disinformation, especially from industries with a vested interest in downplaying climate risks, affect the public's ability to make informed decisions about where to live?
Absolutely. It affects the public's decision, the public's ability to make informed decisions about everything related to climate change, and it's by design. This is a well-documented history of disinformation that we're talking about, and the admitted reason for it in the documents that we have is to sow confusion, to delay action on climate change. And that, of course, is going to trickle down into the way people think about where they're going to live.
Hmm. Becky, I have a follow-up question for you. I want to talk about infrastructure before we get to our callers. We've heard a lot about how overdevelopment in places like Houston and Tampa has increased the scale of disasters. Hurricane Harvey, for example, is cited as an example of how thousands were displaced because of rampant and poorly planned urbanization. For those like me who can no longer keep track of which huge storm was which, Harvey was the one that devastated Houston in 2017. How do you see rapid population growth and inadequate infrastructure exacerbating the risks in places like Florida and Texas? You were starting to talk about that.
Yeah, thanks. I do think it's a big factor. I feel that the sort of policies of fairly unlimited growth and particularly expanding suburban sprawl have characterized a lot of the ways new housing has been created in many Florida cities. Tampa Bay is no exception. And, you know, we have done some research on with interviewees who have shared their experiences, for example, as kids in particular landscapes that used to be, you know, flowing wetlands seasonally, and that they would spend time on the water in springs and rivers and lakes throughout Florida. And many of those bodies of water are now experiencing higher levels of pollution. from runoff, from a variety of sources. And I think the experiences of those changes has been fairly quick and dramatic for a lot of folks who have grown up in the area. So I think that that kind of specific type of development is definitely affecting the sort of overall regional resilience. But one of the things that I would like to highlight, because I, as a resident of Florida, I didn't grow up there. I grew up in East Tennessee, and my heart is definitely with people in Western North Carolina right now, as well as Florida. But I've lived here since 2006, and I think oftentimes the story, the narrative about Florida is as if the entire state is just completely delusional, not necessarily responding to these kinds of risks. So I would like to highlight also the fact that when we started doing this ethnographic research around experiences and perceptions of climate risk 10 years ago, the sort of regional response to that was very different than it is now. So there's a lot of ongoing work by local organizations and institutions, regional planning organizations like the Tampa Bay Estuary Program, CLIO, Climate Action. You know, there's a long list of organizations that I think are really grappling with these issues in a very grounded way, working with communities and neighborhoods that are most at risk. Mm-hmm. And I've been fortunate enough to partner with some of these organizations in their work. So I think that it's an important nuance to kind of note that although it feels that unlimited growth is kind of the story of the day, there's a lot of effort to build in alternative kind of ways of being, ways of making a city more livable through things like community gardening, environmental education with youth around climate risks, mm-hmm. the sort of infrastructural injustices that we were talking about, you know, having young people learn about the histories of those and how there is not a neutral reason for example, the location of our central interstate in the city of Tampa was built as it was in many cities in the U.S. In the central Black business district, many of which businesses and families were displaced to the east, where they then experienced more runoff and flooding issues with stormwater infrastructure that have continued, you know, to the present. So I think there's a complicated story there.
Yeah, it is not always a simple answer. And I'm sorry to interrupt you. We have a bunch of callers and emails that we want to get to. No, that's okay. I wish we could do like multiple shows on this. Maybe we can. That was, by the way, Rebecca K. Zarger, the associate professor in the Department of Anthropology at the University of South Florida. I'm also being joined in the studio today by Lawrence Torcello, associate professor and chair of the Department of Philosophy at RIT, and joining us remotely is Joseph A. Henderson, associate professor of social sciences at Paul Smith's College. The question that we're posing today is, why are people still moving to high-risk areas, given, you know, everything that's showing up in the news left and right as it relates to climate change? Joe, I want to read to you a couple emails that we're getting and get your thoughts on them. First, we've got one from Jen. Jen from Rochester here. I actually consider myself a climate refugee from Dallas, she says. I moved here last year, and it's remarkable. Obviously, moving to the lovely city of Rochester had many other benefits, but having 100-degree days for 4 to 6 months out of the year with air quality alerts every hot day was miserable. I think people living in the South don't realize that it's not that miserable everywhere. But it still blows my mind that people are moving to places like Texas and Florida. I think there's also a disconnect between what the climate is like here in the Northeast versus actually among people in the South. My father is in Dallas, for example, was surprised that it wasn't 30 degrees and snowing last month. I moved here from Los Angeles because of climate-related reasons, so I can completely relate to that. And everyone's saying, I'm not going to visit you because of how cold it is. Okay. And lastly, Joe, before you jump in with your thoughts on this, we also have an email from David who is responding to the question of why people are still moving to high-risk areas. David says, in my humble opinion, the cause is simple. It's FEMA. Here in New York, we pay high taxes. People move to Florida, et cetera, for low taxes. When the inevitable disaster occurs, they expect FEMA to take care of them, especially if they are uninsured. We are subsidizing FEMA, he says. What's the matter with capitalism? Private insurance is available, he says. Therefore, I believe FEMA should be phased out when it comes to real estate issues. Maybe this will change some people's thinking. Joe, tell me what you think about both of those emails, because they bring up, I would say they reflect a lot of what our listeners, I would imagine, are feeling.
It's there's a lot to say here. And I guess before I even jump into those, I want to add two other bits of context to what Becky was talking about, which is I really appreciated how she was talking about the kind of social complexity on the ground in Florida. Florida is also a state that has a demographic boom due to baby boomer retirement, something that, you know, will eventually probably end after they die, speaking, you know, just demographically. So there's that kind of context. You know, Florida is also a state where its governor has signed legislation officially deleting recognition of climate change in state planning documents. And so I think the, you know, to the points of both of those people who wrote in, I think one of the things that, and it really does go back to this question of how we construe and think about freedom, because there's this kind of very individualist understanding of freedom. I can do whatever I want. I can throw my fist however I want. I can move wherever I want. I can, the individual kind of free market will take care of me however I kind of leverage myself within that, right? And then there's something, there are different, like almost more collective understandings of freedom. And I mentioned Scandinavia. I do a lot of work in Denmark as well, where they have a much different understanding of freedom. Their understanding of freedom is kind of freedom to. And so in those kinds of places, it's not freedom from, it's freedom to. They provide, the state provides a lot of really excellent planning and really excellent healthcare and good education. And people in those kinds of situations, when disasters happen, it produces situations of higher social trust and higher levels of social trust. And like, you know, I remember, I'm old enough to remember, I was actually teaching at Rush Henrietta at the time when Hurricane Katrina happened. And, you know, Hurricane Katrina, you got to see, there are these moments in American society where we get to see the kind of like raw brutality of our society on full display. And Katrina was one of those moments, right? Because you had racial and economic inequality playing themselves out in a massive ecological disaster, similarly to COVID, right? And, you know, this is a society that for 40 years has been disinvesting in public infrastructure, disinvesting in public utilities, really hobbling the state's ability to do things like respond well to disasters. And so what do you get? You get a FEMA that is hobbled, underfunded, ineffectual. And that's like a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Because then people are like, well, you know, they're not going to do anything to help me. So I'm on my own. And like, you know, too bad for everybody else, which is basically what we did after COVID, right? Like we were like, well, you know, get back to work. It's a very different response in other parts of the world that have higher levels of social trust. And I worry a lot about those kinds of things as we move forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's reason to worry. Larry, are you worried?
So I want to say I appreciate both perspectives from my fellow guests, and I really appreciate that Rebecca was pointing out some positive things because I think that's super important to always remember when we're dealing with climate change. Otherwise, it becomes very overwhelming. And I agree also a great deal with what Joe is saying. And what I want to point out is that a lot of what we're talking about here, although we're dealing with an ostensibly scientific issue in climate change, we're talking about humanistic issues. We're talking about issues relevant to social science, anthropology, education. And I think it's an important place to bring focus when we're talking about how to deal moving forward with climate change. One of the things that I've come to understand in my investigations of denialism is the importance of the humanities and the social sciences in educationally preparing us for a future of climate change, where we learn to think empathically about others and learn about the racial inequalities that are going to be exacerbated as climate change continues. The plight of immigrants, as Joe has mentioned, this is all things that we learn. These are all things that we learn when we study history, when we study literature, and our ability to think critically about these issues is something that philosophy and its emphasis on logic and ethics brings into the conversation. And so I think it's really crucial to point out that a lot of the problems we're facing with climate change and COVID and in general in the 21st century, the fixes are humanistic fixes and political fixes. And we have the technology and we have the science in place. What we have to do is begin to approach our problems, I think, with a lot more humanism in play.
Larry, let me stick with that subject for a second, because I know that climate skeptics are telling people that climate change isn't a pressing issue. And people like you who are trying to sound the alarm have faced personal attacks for confronting these narratives. How do you navigate these conversations? And what advice would you have for our listeners who might be dealing with similar skepticism in their communities or even their families, especially this time of year and this year in particular?
Right. So, speaking of philosophy, what I've learned works, if anything works, is to be a bit Socratic about this thing. So, when you confront a person head on, it doesn't go well. People dig in, they become defensive, especially if they feel that you're attacking something that they have an ideological investment in, because then it feels personal to them, even if you don't mean it to feel personal to them. But what I mean by becoming more Socratic about it is being willing to listen and to ask questions. I found that if you ask somebody to explain themselves, first they feel like, oh, this person wants to hear what I have to say. And also then they feel that they have to be able to explain themselves next. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the very act of trying to explain why they think something takes off some of the pressure to always feel correct, and they start to realize that maybe they're not as secure in what they think they know or believe as they previously thought. And just a quick anecdote from a class experience once. I was dealing with this in class with a student, and I just, asked the student, who's claiming that climate change was a lot more controversial than it is, where they heard this from. And as soon as the words YouTube had escaped his mouth, he realized that maybe that's not a good source. And so just simply asking somebody to step up to the plate and defend their position is sometimes enough.
Yeah, I hear you. I've been vegan for more than 20 years. I am used to people getting annoyed at me just for existing and not eating the meat at the table, which sometimes people will take to a, as a personal affront. All right, let's get to our caller who has been very patient, Bob in Mendon. Bob, welcome to Environmental Connections. Thanks so much for hanging on the line.
Sure, thanks for taking my call. 2 points. One, when it comes to thinking about places to move, aren't the insurance companies kind of the canary in the coal mine? Like if rates in that area are going up, or if they're dropping people entirely, isn't that a really good indication that that's probably going to be an affected area and you should stay away from it? And the second thing is, we have one of our candidates is kind of touting drill, baby drill when it comes to oil, but then on the other hand is wanting to shut down the borders. And it was mentioned earlier that a lot of the immigrants are coming over here because of climate change reasons. And isn't that a little bit hypocritical?
Thank you, Bob. Okay, which of my panelists wants to take that? That's a two-part. Yes, Joe.
I can take that.
Go ahead.
So I really appreciate the point about the insurance industry, and it is actually one of the major players. And when you're in these kinds of conversations, you know, I did some work at the University of Delaware where they were dealing with coastal issues, and there's this concept of managed retreat and kind of pulling back from certain areas that are too vulnerable. And so, yeah, the insurance industry is speaking very loudly here in places like Florida and California, things like that, where also housing prices are super expensive. So there's a lot of risk for them. And so that is actually one kind of market capitalism that I think we should pay attention to in this regard. The other question was about kind of oil development and carbon-based development and like drill, baby, drill. And I would say that those things are intimately related, which is the long human like conversation and patterns of resource development and how those things are used. And I mentioned really earlier that this is a kind of artifact of that climate change is fundamentally an artifact of capitalism and colonialism and the way in which certain kinds of countries have created their wealth by dispossessing or underdeveloping other parts of the world. So, you know, go to a place like South Africa and look at the waves of dispossession that have gone on in there around natural resources. And I think one of the things I really worry about, and this is a whole separate show, I think, is I do some work and I'm increasingly doing work around fascist responses to climate change. Mm. And what you're discussing there is a kind of fascist response to climate change, which is harden the borders, militarize the borders. We got ours, and so nobody else is going to be allowed in, and we are going to kind of violently maintain the privileges that we have that have been built off of the backs of other people. And I think that's starting to be here already. I think it's certainly coming. You can see it in some of the especially right-wing violence that has occurred around the United States. When you look at some, I mean, this is going to a really dark place, but when you look at some of the like young white male shooter manifestos, they understand climate change at a pretty high level in those. And you know, they respond with this kind of like lifeboat ethics. And that is, you know, there's only so many people that can fit on the boat and we're going to push everybody off. And that's a really violent, ugly world. And I really hope that we avoid that.
Mm. Thank you. Yeah.
I just want to jump in. I'm glad that Joe mentioned fascism and the scientific literacy or climate literacy of shooters aside. The parallel or the connection between fascism and science denialism is historic and it's always been there. And so I just also want to tie that into this mm-hmm. idea of not just repressively dealing with victims of climate change and shutting down the borders and the prioritization and isolation of your own nation, but also the disinformation and propaganda and the denialism that goes along with that also is a sign of a rise in authoritarian thinking, which is very scary in conjunction with climate change, but also in a way what one might expect in a situation like this.
Well, I agree. I think that would be a fascinating topic to further dive into. I have an email from Brenda. We'll have to get to this fairly quickly. Becky, I think you might be the right person to address this email. Hi, Jasmine and guests. Thank you for addressing the issue of climate refuge cities. My parents, who are in their 80s, now qualify as climate refugees. Their modest winter home was ruined by flooding during Hurricane Milton. They had a place in Light and Life Park near Lakeland, home to about 50 retired couples from Rochester affiliated with the Free Methodist Church. My parents don't have the will to rebuild their place, and frankly, they are afraid of the next flood. Of the 200 plus homes there, about 100 were damaged or ruined. They're in mourning for the community they've lost and the sunshine which cheered them in the cold winter months. Fortunately, they have a year-round home in upstate New York, but they're very sad. How can I cheer them up? Please have your guests address the emotional impact of storms, disasters, and the stress involved. Can you briefly address that, Becky, since unfortunately we're getting to the end of the show, but I think that the emotional toll is something that isn't brought up enough. So I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah. Thank you for the question from your caller. I had to kind of take a deep breath actually before replying, because that really hits home. I think the sort of simultaneous experience of feeling grateful that you survived a natural disaster, but at the same time seeing your community be really affected is really tough. Mm-hmm. So yeah, my heart goes out to people who are experiencing that. And I think you're exactly right that from a sort of research and also public policy, social policy perspective, more work into well-being. There's an emerging field looking at the experience of solastalgia, which is seeing environmental degradation as well as climate anxiety, and also natural disaster experiences. There's a long history in my field of anthropology of understanding the sort of specific ways that human communities have responded to disasters. There's some better ways to respond than others. It often can exacerbate existing inequalities. It can also provide opportunities for things like disaster capitalism to take place. I've seen that both in my work in Belize, in Central America, as well as in the Tampa Bay area. I think we're going to be seeing that in the future. So I do think the sort of emotional, social well-being component is an important element. Mm-hmm. I would say that there are a number of people, you know, family and friends who went through the last, you know, several weeks and in multiple places, you know, friends in Western North Carolina, places in Georgia that were hit by Helene, as well as Florida. And I think there's a lot of rethinking of kind of what community means and what we can do to respond to these new risks.
Thank you. And you know what? Let's do a show on it. I know I keep hearing about climate anxiety, but the sadness, it's not necessarily the same subject. There's a lot of overlap, but there's also not. So this has been a really eye-opening conversation, and I want to thank my guests, Lawrence Torcello, Joseph Henderson, and Rebecca Zarger. I also want to give a special thank you to Roisin Meyer and Emily Eli Texcancho for their contributions to today's episodes. To our listeners, thank you so much for joining us. I'm Jasmine Singer. Until next time, thank you for making today's Environmental Connections.